This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present. I just received a wonderful review book in the mail called Out of Place in Time and Space, Inventions, Beliefs, and Artistic Anomalies That Were Impossibly Ahead of Their Time by Mr. Lamont Wood. Mr. Wood, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Glad to be here.
Now, this is a wonderful book. I read the whole thing. I was on a tour promoting my new DVD on the rock singer Del Shannon, and this was kind of my airplane book, and I read the whole thing. It's very well written, very reader-friendly, and the content is absolutely marvelous. You did a great job putting this material together. A lot of it involves art and things that were ahead of their time. Now, Lamont, could you tell us, is there a web page where we could get more information on this book and your other work?
I just direct people to the Amazon page for it. It's a pretty full description of it there.
Okay.
I have not done any other books like this. This is my first book on historical oddities and anomalies. My previous books have mostly been computer books.
Excellent. Again, the title is Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood, and that is available on Amazon.com. Now, as I said, this book is very pithy, very nice to read, very reader-friendly, especially for the business traveler like myself who wants some historical input instead of watching lousy movies on the airplane. So I highly recommend it to the business traveler especially. Now, you have a really wonderfully wide selection of information and topics here, and I would just like to throw a few at you, and you can kind of describe them. Here's a chapter entitled Virgin and Child with Toy Helicopter. That's a wonderful title.
And that's one of the weirder things, actually. Some of these chapters were about beliefs and knowledge that was ahead of their time. But this one is an actual depiction of what we would call a flying model toy helicopter. And nowadays it wouldn't get our attention, but this one is depicted in a painting done in France in 1460, which is not really what you expect in 1460. It's a fairly standard Madonna and Child religious painting. The Christ Child is sitting on the Madonna's lap, of course. And then you look at what's in the Christ Child's hands, and you realize it's a flying toy. And the history of the helicopters is fairly well defined by historians and people. You know, played the various things, and the first man carrying one in 1906, and finally practical device machines with you know full scale production in the 40s. People often point out to me that, you know, Leonardo da Vinci designed a helicopter. But I have to point out that he was 8 years old when this painting was made.
Amazing.
Presumably it was some kind of child's toy centuries before, you know, serious engineers began looking into this.
Amazing.
It makes you wonder what's going on right now among the children.
Oh, amazing, amazing. Now, I love maps myself, and there's a chapter here called Obviously Not Flat about a world map that was published in China in 1602. Could you tell us a bit about this?
Congratulations. That seems to be over the heads of a lot of people. But as I explained there, it's a world map made in China in 1602 or 3. Previously, they hadn't made any world maps in China. They have fairly accurate maps of China, and around it, they would put these blobs and the equivalents of, you know, here be dragons or something. And they really didn't care about the outside world. This one, the two things about it, one, like I said, it was made in China then, and it was a vaguely accurate map of the entire world, which you don't expect. Two is the so-called projection, and the way it's laid out on a rectangular sheet of paper. And it uses, as you know, the problem with maps is that they're flat and the world is round. So you have to use what's called a projection to decide how how you're going to do this, how you're going to display the round surface on the flat piece of paper. And there's going to be distortion. So if the projection you choose, you mathematically basically figure out what distortion you're going to live with, et cetera. And this map from China in 1602 appears to use a projection that was invented in Germany in 1906, which is kind of 300 years out of date. But if you hold them side by side, it is a very good match.
Stunning.
And, we have no explanation for that whatsoever, except, you know, maybe they were pretty smart back then in China, you know. Beyond that map, how they got the information is not that big a mystery, because it had credits in Chinese on it, and it's clear that there was a Jesuit missionary who was heavily involved, a man known to be involved in map making, and presumably they got the world information from him. But like you say, how he came up with that projection, we don't know, except that I would point out that it kind of resembles a map you would get from National Geographic. And in fact, National Geographic has used this 1906 projection, in that it's the edges of it are semicircles, which means that you have these corners left over in a rectangular piece of paper that you can use for things like polar views and other information. And in fact, this map does do that. It had polar views in the corners and some astronomical information, as if it was a National Geographic production. Except, of course, it's not as accurate, and the coloring isn't as good.
It's quite amazing for its time, though.
Yeah, it's just dumbfounding. As I point out in the book, we have to accept the fact that maybe our ancestors were as clever as we are.
Maybe, well, I guess so. Now, there's another artifact that I've talked and published in a lot about, a skeletal remains called Kennewick Man. Could you tell us a bit about Kennewick Man?
Yes, it was a skeleton of someone with Caucasian features found beside river in Kennewick, Washington, on the land owned by the federal government, which caused legal problems later. And there was an arrowhead embedded in his thigh and or pelvis, actually. And so they assumed he was a forgotten pioneer. And until they did carbon dating on the bones and realized they were 8,000 or 9,000 years old, which is really hard to do if you're Caucasian in the Pacific Northwest, to be 8,000 or 9,000 years old, because, you know, the Caucasians imply Europeans. They didn't show up till 1492 in any big way. So this guy was really lost, apparently.
Amazing.
And there is no explanation. There's some analysis saying, well, maybe it's more Caucasoid than Caucasian, which means he could be from the Japanese Ainu. That was the Aborigines from northern Japan. Northern Japan's an awful long way off also. I think Europe's probably closer. So that's not a very satisfying explanation. But as I also point out, you know, when you track it back that far, the DNA is, you're not really sure what you're getting at. I mean, the DNA component of whatever groups were moving around back then may not match what we think of now. The shorthand we use for race, you know, may not match what we use nowadays.
Another great mystery. Yeah,
it's fascinating, but we need to know more about this before we can, you know, make any real decisions.
You talk a lot about information and ideas that came before their time. I'm broadcasting now from Everett, Massachusetts, and there was a man here named Van Bush, who was the founder of Raytheon. Raytheon means divine light, by the way, and Everett's on the Mystic River, and it's named after the transcendental thinker Edward Everett, so there are all these mystical connotations. What did Van Bush do and say that makes him distinguished?
Well, Vannevar Bush, he wrote an article in The Atlantic Monthly in 1945 based on his experience as President Franklin Roosevelt's science advisor during World War II, and talking about basically the information overload that he was dealing with the whole time, and that the paper-based information management tools that he was stuck with were inadequate, and we need to move on to something else. And the something else he described is indistinguishable from a microfilm embedded in your desk, and you'd have these viewers on your desk with these screens and a keyboard and various controls that we now know as forward and back buttons. This is so familiar.
Yeah.
And like say multiple screens, and you would have links that we would now refer to as hypertext. And the desk would also have a scanner, so you could input stuff, and there would be some kind of printer, probably microwave output or fax or something. You're a little vague on this. When you read about it, you can get to that article nowadays online and read it on your browser, and it's a very eerie experience reading it and realizing he's talking about you doing in the act of reading the article. As if he foresaw all the thing, all the stuff we're doing nowadays. He didn't foresee how. He thought there'd be some kind of electromechanical, optical way of doing this. He does mention thermion tubes or something like that, which was what they had back then for transistors. And of course, nowadays computers are based on transistors with billions of them. So it took a while to actually get to where he wanted to go, but we have pretty much gotten there, I believe.
Amazing.
It's not clearer than he could have known, really.
Bizarre. Now, just a subject, Hupp, which you do wonderfully in this book, and that's why it's such a fascinating book for people on the run, like myself, who's always going somewhere. Each chapter is complete. It's short.
Yeah,
it's pithy. But just one more time for our streaming listeners. The book is called Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood, and it's available on Amazon.com. Now, Lamont, you touch into another thing that's fascinated me since I was about 8 years old, and that is the Kosovo UFO in 1350. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I have a number of chapters based on what people think or see as depictions of UFOs or flying saucers in medieval or Renaissance church art. And as I point out, that when we see UFOs in there, we may be imposing our visual vocabulary on the people who did not have that vocabulary, who had another vocabulary. And especially with the Kosovo thing, when you look into it, they have these objects in the sky on either side of the cross during the crucifixion scene. And of course, part of a fresco inside the dome of a monastery in Kosovo, which of course outside the mountains outside of Albania. They were first pointed out in the 1960s, and it probably got people's attention then because those things look like Mercury space capsule. But I would point out that one of them is silver and has a person inside it with a male face, and it's moving toward the cross, and the other is red and has a female figure in it, and it's moving away from the cross, and that is standard Byzantine iconography for representing the crucifixion, because the Gospels mention that it was dark on the day of the crucifixion between noon and 3 p.m., so they have to have some iconography in the picture showing that the lighting is changing. So you have the sun moving one direction and the moon moving the other. But if you want to see UFOs, I can't stand in your way, can I?
No. And Lamont, that's a big part of the fun of this book. I had some friends over last night, and I was showing them some of the stuff. The debates you get in between skeptics and believers and people who don't care at all, it's quite wonderful. It's very thought-provoking and stimulating and really gets people wondering about history one way or the other. Well, it's amazing that, let's say that wasn't UFO iconography, that someone would even draw something that would remind someone of a UFO 500 or 600 years later is in itself amazing.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
That stands on its own as a mystery, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you don't have to believe that there's anything in the sky. Why is there this continuity, you know? Maybe that should be investigated. So yes. And beyond that, as I point out, you know, you can't prove a negative. You can't prove that there aren't people in flying saucers up there, benevolent extraterrestrials who are watching us, et cetera, et cetera. But I also point out that, I keep sticking to the Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation is the best. And for all that, we have to invent these people in the sky and the tech technology and all right. that, and that seems to go a long way.
Right, quite wonderful. Now, you do a few other little fun things that I like. You have a chapter called Wag the Dog, which is all completely contemporary. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that is about the movie Wag the Dog, which came out about 1 month before the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal broke out. Well, maybe about 2 months. Anyway, it had gone through the theaters and you know, been done with it. And then suddenly this came out. Now, let me explain. The movie is about a president of the United States who is involved in a sex scandal and decides what he should do is start a military crisis in Albania to distract, you know, the voters. And then, of course, Clinton gets into this scandal with Monica Lewinsky about the time the Kosovo thing breaks out, which is, of course, next door to Albania. It's very freaky, basically, and as I say, if life imitates art, life would be a lot easier, actually.
It would be, wouldn't it? Quite amazing. Now, seeing as this show is called Sphinx Radio, you have a chapter on the Great Sphinx. Could you tell us some of the anomalies you discovered about the Great Sphinx?
Well, basically, that everything we think we know about it may be total conjecture and completely wrong. The big thing about it, the Sphinx, is that it's sitting on the edge of the Giza Plateau and is surrounded by pharaonic architecture that we can pretty much date because the guy's name is on it, basically. And on those monuments and stuff, you can see chisel marks. I mean, there's almost no weathering. The average rainfall there is like 1 inch a year, and it's fair. And some of that stuff looks pretty virgin, frankly. The pharaohs left behind, but the Sphinx itself shows considerable weathering from the flow of water, and it's right next to this stuff that is pristine and dry. Where did this water come from? Why did it only affect the Sphinx? Well, there are people willing to believe that the Sphinx must be thousands of years older than the pharaonic stuff, right, that the pharaoh built stuff around it. Because we know that during the last ice age, the area was wet. Then the ice age ended, and we have the current climate. So maybe it was built toward the end of the last ice age, but that puts us back like 10,000 years, or at least certainly more than 4,000 years, or when we think it was built. And others say that, well, no, maybe the runoff was messed up by the other architecture, and it just got more exposure to running water. At this point, I don't think we have enough grounds to decide either way, but it does leap out at you that there is something going on there that needs explanation. Now, as for the records of the Atlantis civilization being hidden under the left paw of the Sphinx, they haven't found that, and I'm not holding my breath, but that's been predicted also.
Amazing. Now, you're in the computer field, and what I was quite amazed, I didn't hear anything about this. There were actually home computers, like the one I'm using now, as late back as 1968. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, yeah. Like I say, the book is about topics that were out of place in time,
right,
and people who were way ahead of their time. In this case, let me explain. People usually, when you say personal computer, they think about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and all this stuff. And these people who really got active in about 1977, and that's when they really started hitting the market, or got their start by 1975 anyway, when they started taking over to technology. There were some people in San Antonio, Texas, who organized a company in late 68, I think, or 69, and managed to come to market in late 1970 with a desktop computer, a personal computer. From glancing at it, the only real difference between something you would expect to see nowadays is that the screen was a half height rather than a full height, because they didn't want it to be large and intimidating. And, for several reasons, that was the big one. Beyond that, this machine, when they built it, they sat down and wrote up what we call an instruction set, what's actually got to go on there in terms of what the bits are doing. And Yeah, but, you know, give us time. And in the meantime, they came out with their computer. It's called the DataPoint 2200. They later changed the name of the company to DataPoint. And sold it based on the original design with the processor and stuff done on large circuit boards. Intel came back rather late with the chip based on it. And by that time, the DataPoint people said we'd gone on and designed version 2 of this. We don't want a chip that embodies version 1. And they said, and both sides said, okay, we'll keep what we have, and that'll be the end of it. And DataPoint got no intellectual property ownership out of it. They just washed their hands of it.
Amazing.
And what's that?
I say amazing.
Yes, they washed their hands. It could be one of the stupidest business decisions of the 20th century. Anyway, Intel put this in their catalog, called it the 8008, and it was kind of there were some comedy features about it because they only had 18 input-output pins, and you needed much more than that. And they had to add all these other chips to what they call multiplex, the lines. So eventually, they came out with an advanced version called the 8080, which also ran faster. They had 40 pins. And this was the basis for the first wave of the microprocessors, the things Gates and Jobs were doing, starting from late 1975 on. They later came out with the 8088, and that was the basis of the IBM PC. And the subsequent developments of that is called the X86 dynasty, basically. And if you have any kind of a desktop computer, including nowadays an Apple, it is using basically a modernized version of that chip. So basically any microprocessor nowadays is a modernized DataPoint 2200. It's all derived from that first machine in San Antonio, Texas, which is now completely forgotten. And that company, like a lot of other small computer makers at the time, didn't understand the PC revolution when it came along, and they kept selling their own stuff, and they were drowned by the resulting tidal wave and went out of business. Not only them, but virtually all the any competitor there you could mention, just clean sweep, all gone.
Companies like Wang and everything, yeah, they're just not what they were. Stunning. Now, we're about out of time, Lamont. I want to give out the name of the book once more. It's Out of Place in Time and Space, Inventions, Beliefs, and Artistic Anomalies That Were Impossibly Ahead of Their Time. That is out by New Page Books by Lamont Wood, and it is available on Amazon.com. Now, Lamont, I demand that you write a sequel to this book because I enjoyed it so much, and there's lots of other... If you need ideas for topics, email me, and I'll send them to you.
Okay, I might do that, yes.
I highly recommend this book to everybody. It's wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you for being on Sphinx Radio, and we'll have you back on. Maybe if you don't come out with a sequel, we'll look at some of the other things in this book at another time. We just scratched the surface, and thank you once again for being on Sphinx Radio.
Thank you.